Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I am so thrilled to be joined today by Maggie Shipstead to talk about her just excellent epic novel, Great Circle. So let me tell you about her. Maggie Shipstead is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Astonish Me and Seating Arrangements and the winner of the Dylan Thomas Prize and the LA Times Book Prize for First Fiction. She's a graduate of IO Writers Workshop, a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and the recipient of a fellowship from the NEA. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Maggie, you've written the kind of book that I feel like so many people want to read, like, and that they're it's like one of the main things that people seek out, just like a big fat novel that you can get lost in. Tell me about the escapism of the book and the escapism in the book.
So yeah, I love a big fat novel. And I wasn't necessarily planning to write one. I had written both my other books in under a year and assumed that that was just the kind of person I was. I would just magically write all my books in under a year. That turned out not to be the case. The first draft took me 3 years and 3 months. I started writing it in fall of 2014 and I sold it 2 years and 8 months ago, whatever year that was, 2018, I guess, maybe.
Do the math.
Yeah. And so of course we couldn't have seen the pandemic coming. And I think in some ways that's really changed the context of it as it's being published, kind of this moment when people are getting vaccinated and things are, the light at the end of the tunnel is a little bit brighter. And I think everyone's really hungry for, you know, freedom and a sense of movement. And those are the two things that really drive my main character, Marion Graves. She sort of has devoted her life to seeking and preserving freedom, which involves a lot of sacrifice. So yeah, it was a bit happenstance that the escapism is sort of as timed to this moment as it hopefully is.
But as I was reading the novel, I kind of felt like, why doesn't everyone want to go into aviation today? Like, there's the metaphorical meaning of flying, but there is also the very literal escape hatch that flying provides.
Yeah, I really came to appreciate flight a lot more in the writing of this. I've never been like a big airplane person. I'm not a super nervous flyer, but I'm someone where when there's turbulence, I like grab the armrest really hard, like that kind of flyer. Sure. My brother is just leaving the Air Force after 20 years, and he used to fly the C-130, the big 4-propeller cargo plane. And he was one of those children who's just obsessed with airplanes, knew he wanted to be a pilot. And to me, that seems like a commonality amongst most of the pilots I read about or have met. They just know, there's just something about it. And so for my character, Marion, I think she's more, as a child, she's really free range child. It sort of doesn't occur to her there are any limitations on her. She knows she wants to see the larger world. And so when she first encounters airplanes in the form of biplanes being flown by sort of traveling barnstormers in 1927, it's just like, oh, this is my vehicle to the kind of life I want, which of course is a more complex proposition than she can imagine at the beginning, but that's sort of, it's her kind of thunderbolt or epiphany moment, I guess.
If there's ever been a year to make the moms in your life feel loved and appreciated on Mother's Day, it's this one. I've missed seeing and hugging my mom regularly this year, and I know she feels the same. That's why I'm honoring my mom with a heartfelt, sentimental gift the whole family can cherish together forever. Storyworth. Storyworth is an online service that helps you and any mother figure in your life share stories through thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's a fun new way to engage with them, especially if you can't be together in person. Every week, Storyworth emails your mom a different story prompt, questions you might never have thought to ask, like, what is some of the best advice your mother ever gave you? And if you could choose any talents to have, what would they be? Storyworth has helped numerous families learn about each other in profound, special ways, and their testimonials will practically move you to tears. There's no shortage of surprises when reading the weekly stories, and they make your family feel closer, even if you're not together. After 1 year, Storyworth will compile all your mom's stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. Give your mom the most meaningful gift with Storyworth. Get started right away with no shipping required by going to storyworth.com/Maris. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's storyworth.com/Maris for $10 off.
There's no way to literally get stuck in the circumstances you're in when you can just fly away.
Well, theoretically, I mean, she learns that, you know, you need money for flying lessons, sure, and airplanes don't grow on trees and they need fuel and you can't land everywhere. And so some of her life is just this process of like understanding the limitations, even of her sort of realized dream. And she is in for some rude awakenings, I suppose.
I like how the novel begins with an explanation of the concept of the Great Circle. Because I feel like when I think about the globe, it's so hard to visualize the bottom of the Antarctic. And mm-hmm. I feel like there are maps in this book. There will be maps in this book. I only saw the galley. And it's just so hard to reorient one's brain to think about that.
Totally. You never see the planet from that angle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a great circle is a geometric term, you know, it's the circumference of the circle at its largest point. So as it says in the book, the equator is a great circle, and then every line of longitude, so going through the north and south poles. And so I think most people know this, but like the reason a commercial airliner takes that curved trajectory is it's following part of a great circle. It's the shortest distance. But yeah, Antarctica, I mean, I've been to Antarctica twice to two different sides of it. And even having done that, it's hard for me to orient it in relation to the bottoms of the continents. I really have to look. And that is one of the maps in the book, sort of shows on Marian's Around the World flight. You know, she comes from South Africa, crosses East Antarctica to the Ross Ice Shelf, which will be meaningless to most people with good reason. And one of my sort of big challenges in constructing her flight was that in 1950, this sort of flight would have been borderline impossible. And the big reason would have been Antarctica. And there were no permanent bases there at that point. So there, and you would have to refuel this plane twice.
Right.
So I used a real historic expedition that was in East Antarctica at that time as one source of fuel, sort of constructing a way that they could bring fuel for her. And then she also refuels on the Ross Ice Shelf, where there were bases that had been used and then just sort of get abandoned, and they have a bunch of fuel there. And I have been there, although the Ross Ice Shelf is a floating platform of ice. It's about the size of France. It's enormous. And so pieces of it are always breaking off and floating away and dissolving and melting, as it were. And so that has long ago happened to these bases that used to be there.
The novel reminds me that if you're interested in flying, then you have to be interested in water. And I wouldn't have drawn as tight a connection between Marion's start in life. She and her brother, twin brother, are rescued off of a sinking boat, to the later stages in her life when she is flying above water so often.
Yeah. I think it is difficult to wrap our, the way we travel now, modern travel is so fast that it's difficult to wrap your mind around how dominant water is on the planet. Of course, we all learn it in school, we know, but
yeah.
So in 2012, right before Seating Arrangements came out, I'd been traveling for like 5 months and I was writing Astonish Me, and I was in Europe. And just to be extra, I guess, I took the Queen Mary 2 across the Atlantic. And my kind of reason for doing it was I was really like, how big is an ocean? Like, what is it like to spend days just chugging across empty water? And I mean, the truth is it was illuminating, but it wasn't like, you can't tell you're moving. Of course, you're just at the center of the disk. Nothing changes except the sun goes up and over and you like lose a time zone every day or every other day. And now, partly because of the travel I did in researching this book and also just writing for magazines, I've spent a lot of time at sea. I really enjoy it. I think it's amazing. And I think it's wild to see animals out there just going about their business, you know, in the middle of nowhere, some dolphins go by and you're like, what are you doing? But that's their world. But yeah, I mean, pilots just inevitably also have to deal with the challenges of flying over water. And lots of those early pilots in the 20s and 30s, when people are really paying close attention to flight, those were sort of a lot of the big milestones in aviation. Of course, Charles Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic. And if you see the Spirit of St. Louis in the Air and Space Museum, it's like a clothes basket. You know, it's nothing. Like, there's nothing in the world that would make me fly across an ocean in that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I love you of course incorporate a lot of real history into this story, and we hear about what Amelia Earhart's doing and all of these other benchmarks that are being set. How do you incorporate the historical into the fiction?
Yeah, it was important to me to sort of situate Marion in this real world context. So, and I did that in a few ways, like the section, there are these sections called the Incomplete Histories, where I'd sort of zoom through a long period of, in one case, I'd do one for, I know you've read the book, but for those who haven't, like, yes. I do almost a prehistoric history of Missoula, Montana, which is where Marion grows up, and kind of zip through the history, or I do something similar with aviation. I had one for Antarctica, but that got cut in the edits, which was probably for the best, but still kind of sad. And then, yeah, I wanted to kind of acknowledge the existence of these real pilots. I think, you know, in the years when I was working on this book and people would ask what I was writing about and I would describe it, and the universal response was, oh, like Amelia Earhart. And it's totally understandable, but it's also interesting to me because at the time, again, in the 20s and 30s, there were lots of female pilots who were basically household names, who were like really, really famous. And Amelia Earhart's the only one who's persisted, you know, as a Halloween costume and, you know, his biography day in elementary school type famous person. And it's because she disappeared. Like, other people made comparable accomplishments, and hers were very real. But there's this kind of cottage industry around her vanishing that was kind of one of the sparks for the book, because I'm curious about this difference between disappearance and death. Like, often they are the same thing functionally, but we process them really differently. And I think it's overwhelmingly likely that Amelia Earhart crashed in the ocean and drowned. Like, these islands where she could have been a castaway are so far away from where she was. She had no fuel. That was the whole problem. You know, and then something will surface every couple of years and everyone like passes it around. And then like 3 weeks later, it'll be debunked, but nobody passes that around. And so it's perpetuated this sort of myth and kind of a circus, you know, like, I almost, not to be a total curmudgeon, but I find it almost disrespectful that there's this whole like, what really happened? And it's like, yeah, she drowned. It sucked, you know, like she didn't build a coconut house.
But we have stories we want to tell ourselves, which gets us to the other main peg of your story, about the actress Hadley, who's going to play Marion in a film. And before we get to her doing that, she has a lead role in what was a kind of YA fan fiction-y kind of
Twilight-esque. Twilight-esque.
Yes. And she even goes so far, and this is in her voice, not yours. She calls the people, the fans, crazy bitches, because they just want to believe in the story so badly that they're so invested in this fiction.
Yeah.
That seems like what we're doing. We are doing fan fiction for Amelia Earhart, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way. But yeah, it's true. I think, just to clarify, I actually would never say the word bitch about another woman. I hate that word.
I wanted to clarify.
I've read that section aloud. It was actually the first part of this book I ever read aloud. And it was at Breadloaf like years ago. And I could kind of see people in the audience reacting as I said. I was like, the crazy bitches just over and over again. But yeah, in writing about Hollywood, I mean, it was sort of a different integration of reality than I did with Marion, in that I was sort of purposefully borrowing from Hollywood tropes or real life stories. Like the character sort of has a Kristen Stewart-esque yeah. moment where she's sort of, she's been dating her co-star in this series, and the fans have sort of invested their relationship with all the fervor they feel about the characters. And it's just this unbearable pressure. And so she sort of publicly cheats on him, knowing she'll get photographed. And then there's also, you know, there's kind of a Me Too moment, which I think was in the manuscript before the Harvey Weinstein news broke. But the thing is, like, I don't think anyone was surprised about Harvey Weinstein. Like, on the one hand, it was a huge bombshell, and on the other, like, everybody knew. You know, and there's a reason, like, casting couch jokes exist and that sort of thing. And so I really like to play with the familiar and sort of in some ways use the reader's, my presumed, like, their pre-existing knowledge of these things is almost like a boost or a head start. And I just did a conversation with Curtis Sittenfeld, and obviously she's written about Laura Bush and Hillary Clinton. And the way she put it was that when she does that, she feels like it's the equivalent of when you're talking to a friend. And it's one thing if you're describing someone to them, you can kind of tell them about this person. But if you're talking about someone you both know, it's so much juicier and you have this commonality. And she was like, that's what I feel like I'm doing, is having this conversation about someone we both know. And I was like, yes, I'm going to repeat that as though I thought of it.
No, I love it. And then as a reader, we become more implicated because, well, I thought to myself, wait, am I the crazy bitch of reading this book?
Yes. Yes.
Definitively yes. Thank you for clarifying. But I do think it spoke to my expectations for what I wanted from the story and what a story's capabilities really are.
Yeah. And one thing I thought about one thing Hadley says when she's talking about just this really passionate fandom that this franchise inspires, and she talks about how angry people get when they change one little thing or when the story doesn't give them exactly what they want. In some ways, fan fiction can be an outlet for this. Like, you want more of something yeah. from the story, so you write it yourself and make it true. And Hadley thinks that our favorite stories are often stories, and I think the word I use in the book is like a little itch to them. Like, there's something a little unsatisfying, and maybe it's just me, but that's how a lot of my favorite narratives function. There's just something about them that's like sort of annoying or sort of incomplete. And that's kind of what will keep drawing me back to a book. Like, a book that's perfectly satisfying, I'll read once and be perfectly satisfied, but right. I don't like come back to be like, wait, but what?
And so tell me a little bit more about the juxtaposition between Hadley and Marion. And, you know, they have parallel stories, in that their parents have either died or abandoned them. Tell me what juxtaposing their stories reveals about them.
Yeah, so I don't outline or plan my books at all. I would if I could. It doesn't work for me. So I just have to kind of go and hope for the best. And so I was probably 3 weeks into writing Great Circle and was just kind of writing this like ship launch scene in 1909, and then sat down one day and wrote. The first section I wrote in Hadley's voice was this part where she publicly cheats on her famous boyfriend. And on the surface, that section has literally nothing to do with Marion Graves. There was no connection whatsoever, but I just knew this was the missing piece. And often to get momentum on a project, I need two components of some kind. So the idea that she would play Marion in a biopic, I had pretty early, but then exactly how to connect the stories was probably the biggest challenge of this book, which had many enormous challenges and was a total nightmare to write. But I also didn't want, if I just had it be Marion, I felt like it would have just been this sort of like, you know, cheese ball of like historic fiction, just one texture, one thing kind of. And so I really, and as I was a couple years into drafting, it dawned on me how long it would be. And it used to be longer. This is actually about 25% shorter than when I sold it. And I just like needed something different that would cut through that, like a different tone, like something a little sharp and sour. And so it's kind of this acidic, you know, accent piece, but it also Hadley's point of view also gave me a means to kind of have a different perspective on Marion. And kind of one of my preoccupations in the book is how much of a life gets lost when we die, you know, all our thoughts, all our experiences kind of go away with us. And so if you're trying to construct someone's life, even someone right now who you know, you can't, there's a limit to how well you can know anyone. And certainly then Hadley looking back 70 years at this sort of lost figure, trying to piece it together. So I wanted that to be able to show sort of this game of telephone that happens between vanished aviator and then a movie about her. And there's also a novel about her. And so I wanted them to be sort of bound together, but not too tightly. And there was sort of a version at one point where it was more like Hadley was like in a library finding papers about Marion and piecing things together. And that didn't really work. And yeah, it took a long time to really sort of resolve it in a way that that worked for me.
I also, of course, see the parallel that very explicitly Marion and her twin brother Jamie are drawn to the void, as you would say. They want to wrap their heads around things that are too enormous to comprehend. And it feels like Hadley's getting there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, so when I was writing it, a friend of mine asked if I had to describe what the book was about in one word, what would it be? And I said, scale. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly kind of what you're describing. Like, what's one life, the scale of one life versus the scale of the planet? What's the scale of one life versus all the lives being lived? You know, the planet versus geological time, all these things. And so I think Hadley and, or sorry, Jamie and Marion, you know, as orphans, of having had, as having had this brush with death as infants and the shipwreck, you know, they're sort of set up to be seekers and their father disappears. And so to them, there's always this horizon with some answer over it, you know, like, where did my father go? What would have happened, or what would have meant if, you know, they'd drowned as babies, that sort of thing. And so they're both sort of compelled just to go look for this answer to an unanswerable question. And that's part of what I thought about with Marion's flight too, which she doesn't complete it, but if she had, what would that even mean? You know, the whole nature of a circle is that if you complete it, you're back where you started. And then what?
Right.
And the horizon just stretches out in front of you all over again.
And I don't want to get too spoilery, but you do just a really immersive description of when she is flying in the poles, just how, what that experience was like back then, which I think is a really specific kind of thing. Cause I assume that now there are radars and technology. No, tell me.
Well, I mean, yes. And flying in the, this was true in the book as well, that there was a lot more navigational, or a lot more navigational aids were present in the Arctic, partly because it's just convenient, you know, for getting from parts of North America to Europe, which in the war was necessary. Although even then it was a bit sketchy and they would sort of do it in legs. And now, you know, commercial airliners fly over the North Pole all the time, but not over the South Pole. It just doesn't make sense as a route. And part of it's because it's so, Antarctica is so far south. Like, the continents all end further north than we think. Like, there are human settlements to the north that are pretty that are around like 70 degrees north, but 70 degrees south, like Antarctic trips from South America don't even go remotely that far south. Like most of them don't even cross the Antarctic Circle, which is 66 degrees south. So it's so far away. There's not much in the way of navigational aids. I think some of the big permanent bases have them, like McMurdo Station would have them. But I did a story for Outside Magazine in 2016, I think, and it was about the unit of the Air National Guard that does all our polar airlift. And it's just like, they have to practice. It's really specialized flying because you get these weird, it's a weird visual effect. So the white snow and often the white sky, and you cannot tell. It's incredibly disorienting. And I knew I needed to go to Antarctica to write the book, which I did. I wrote A Modern Love about one trip, and then another was for a magazine assignment, but you don't go into the Antarctic interior. It's just, sure, you can as a tourist, but it's prohibitively expensive. And so I was like, I really want to know what it's like to just like be on that ice sheet. And so in this story for Outside, I went with this unit to Greenland, which is where they go in the summer to practice for the Antarctic summer, and landed on the ice sheet in this plane. And it was, you know, it's such a simple visual, just this white disc with this dome of blue sky, but I couldn't have, the feeling of the, again, the scale of it was just like nothing I could have imagined. And this sort of weird feeling, like you're kind of standing on the skin of a water balloon or something, because you're standing on thousands of feet of ice and just nothing in any direction. It was astonishing. And it's something I needed to kind of bring into the book. But this sort of flight, even today, would be challenging and is rarely done.
And then even as you describe your experience, then you have to take that extra step of actually translating it and writing it down into a form that people can understand and read. And that must have been really challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, with anything heavily researched, there's always the danger of just like including things because you went to the trouble of looking them up. And so sort of like, how does this feel organic? What would actually be important to Marion's experience? How do you make it clear to the reader what it would be like, and also why it matters? You know, like the, just some of the navigational challenges of the polar regions, like how your compass doesn't quite work correctly, and how charts don't really, it's difficult to visually represent this place where all these lines of longitude are coming together and everything gets sort of thrown out of proportion. And so that to me sort of also lends kind of a mystery or a distortion or something to these regions.
Really does. And I felt upon reading it that I was disoriented too. So I guess
that's it. Yeah. And also doing the north-south flight, you get these wild changes in climate. Like you have these, islands in the South Pacific, and then you're in the polar night, and then you're in the polar summer. And it's just an epic sort of slice of the whole planet.
Amazing. This has been so wonderful. Before you go, will you recommend a few books for us?
Sure. There's so many books I love, and I'm always reading sort of a smorgasbord, but I thought I would recommend some of the books that I sort of think are sort of sisters to Great Circle, in that they're these epics and books that I looked to while I was reading. So I love The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert, about a 19th century botanist who's also a world traveler. Life After Life by Kate Atkinson, structurally so interesting, how her main character dies and is reborn and has all these different tries at her life. And at first it felt like a video game, and then I thought it was exhilarating. Pachinko for family epic, Tale for the Time Being for sort of using unusual voices. And then one of my big inspirations for Hadley was Veronica by Mary Gateskill, which has this sort of intense first person voice and this sort of porousness between past and present that I wanted to use. So all of those books I've read more than once and always go back to.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maris. It was great to see you.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.